I left the OU about 6 years ago and had coffee this morning with someone that I used to work with, which is kind of surreal and quite nice. So it's nice to be back. Apologies also to the University of Hull. I seem to have done something strange with some of my TIFFs this morning, but since the logo changes on an almost weekly basis, it probably would have been inaccurate anyway. I'm from Massey University in New Zealand. I'm here with Kevin. Kevin, stick your hand up. That's Kevin. Any compliments should come to me at the end. Any questions or queries should go to Kevin. What I'm going to do is talk very briefly about the background to what I'm here to talk about, which is about reusing some of the learning designs that we've been developing over the last couple of years and their origin. I will try not to do the thing of jumping slides, but I'm very conscious of time too. I do have some of the live examples. I'm not going to be as brave as Diana and actually try and show you stuff live working, because it never works for me, ever. But I do have them with me on the laptop, so if anyone wants to grab us over lunch or in between sessions, I'm very happy to do that. We were asked by JISC about 2 years ago to look at developing some take-up assistance materials for a new digitization program that they were working on, News Film Online Archive, which some of you may be familiar with. And we made a decision very early on in the process that we wanted to get away from the kind of content paradigm. You know, we did our workshop tests with colleagues, and they would come along, look at the archive, ask if they if it had anything on Cobalt 13. You'd search, not find anything, and they would write the archive off as being irrelevant and useless to them. So we took a slightly different approach, which was essentially to think about the way in which you would use an object, the kind of activity, the kind of engagement that students would be asked to perform, the way they would work together, the way they would work with you, and that we would have those professional conversations. And then to go to an archive such as the News Film Online Archive and look for a resource which would support that pedagogic approach. So we were, I was accused last week at the JISC conference of being evangelical, so I'm going to be quite careful how I put this. But literally, we were quite adamant that we didn't want people to go to the archive as a content repository that they were searching for content. We wanted them to go to it as a place where there would be opportunities for engaging students with predetermined learning activities. And we did that by developing this kind of task-based approach. We thought about the things you would do with an archive clip from the News Film Online, the kinds of things that you would ask students to do when looking at it. And we did that through a whole series of conversations with colleagues, with each other, lots of bottle of Merlot on train rides, basically thinking about the kinds of things that you would be asking students to do whilst working with a clip, and then work back from that to design the kinds of learning activities. And this was a really fascinating process for us, because we weren't designing new radical pedagogies. What we were doing was looking at existing frameworks, existing approaches, our own experience, reading some of the literature about learning and teaching, and trying to work out whether there were lots of good examples that we could in some way codify. So we ended up with a matrix. This is the paper-based tool that we took to workshops, and we ran 3 workshops as part of this DISC project. I think we've in total had about 150 people or so, 130, 150 people. We've done this at a couple of conferences and things around the place over the last couple of years as well. And essentially, there are 2 axes to this. One is getting individuals to think about the spaces in which they're working, and the other is to think about the kind of, and we were calling them learning designs. I have to confess, we called them learning designs before we were fully aware of the learning designs communities that already existed. 2 years ago, I was unaware of those things. And we ended up defining the kinds of engagements, if you like, which we defined as learning designs. I'm just going to reorientate that for you, because it might be easier for you to see. You can see down the left-hand side there are those 10 learning designs, the kinds of engagement that you want students to be involved in, and then along the bottom, the spaces in which that teaching might take place. Now, these categories on the left-hand side, some of them are familiar, I'm sure, because we've just mentioned a few, break down in different ways. So I'm just going to give you one example. There are references at the end. If you want to go and look at the framework more, then there'll be some references for you to do that at the end. I'm going to try and focus today on this issue about codifying with LAMS and other tools. But just to give you a very quick example, we looked at something like stimulation. How do people use video in their learning and teaching. And of course, at its worst, it's sit them down in front of 45 minutes of content and play that instead of delivering whatever it was one was delivering. In other instances, it's find something a bit funny to give them a laugh. And so people play the odd funny clip. What we were interested in was thinking about the kind of stimulation that we might engage learners. I'll give you a quick example. We looked at something like topping and tailing. What would happen if we took an archive clip and played it without the sound? It'd be unfamiliar to students, and they wouldn't hear the soundtrack. And to use that just as a stimulus for their interest, deliver the lecture, I'm tempted to say in the normal way, but one would hope not, and then at the end play the clip again, but with the sound. What does that do? What does that do to the learner's engagement in that session? Something very, very simple. Maybe to play a clip and pause it, the kind of what happens next idea. Again, just play a little bit of the clip, stop it, move on to do the learning experience with the students, and then play that clip again at the end. So we were just trying to provoke people to think about the clips from this archive, not in their content terms, but in the way in which they would stimulate some kind of response from the learner. And we had examples for all of these things. We were asked to illustrate all of these things, and we did our best. The result is that on the GISC website at the end of that project, there is that same matrix available. It's being populated at the moment with resources. There are some video case studies of work that we've done with various project partners, people talking about their use. There are some pedagogic examples. And indeed, there are some very simple tutorials on, you know, how to embed video or how to remove the soundtrack from a video and so on. So that was our GISC project. And we actually probably did, I think, quite a lot more than we were being asked to do. But it started us thinking, more train journeys, more project meetings, more bottles of Merlot. And we ended up thinking about the way in which these different designs related to each other. So like a lot of people, you end up thinking, Cobb's got a lot to answer for, really. We started thinking about these cycles and the way that these things fed on each other and the way that they might develop over time. And we wanted to move beyond video, because we were then being asked to bring this framework and talk to other digitization projects that GISC were running, projects around medical backfiles, newspapers, sound archives, and so on. And so we started thinking, although video is great, because it's, in some ways it's the easiest to work with, it's almost stimulating just because it's stimulating. It's nothing more enjoyable than watching a British Gaumont news clip from the 1940s if or something, if only just for the accent that you get. But we wanted to move beyond that. And so we started thinking about some of the different designs and the different archives and the way they might be used. So rather than thinking about things like mise-en-scène in purely film terms, which was easy with the video archive, we thought, well, what does that mean? If you take these ideas about how ideas are represented, and instead of using it with film, you use it in the newspaper archive, what kind of issues come up in terms of representation? And this is a very simple example of looking at perhaps a university order of ceremony and looking at something from a newspaper archive of a processional order and getting students to compare and contrast. Another quick example, I haven't littered it with lots of examples. Another example is taking something from the medical back archives and using a clip which, you know, is very content-driven, perhaps for some people, it's around assisted suicide and euthanasia, but actually you could use that with students in any discipline if what you wanted them to do was to explore the idea of walking in someone else's shoes, the idea of empathy, of being able to role-play and see things from different perspectives. And indeed, our argument as we went through the project was that we wanted people to work outside some of their kind of natural subject boundaries. Was it organized at the same time as the SETI conference, I presume, which is the background noise? So this led us, this is really why I'm here today with Kevin, this led us to think about how the learning design, that learning framework that we've ended up developing as a consequence of the project, how it would work with all of these rich resources, not just the News Film Archive, not just the other GISC digitization projects, but we've been working with a colleague, Theo Kuschel, who's been looking at a whole range of other free materials from Library of Congress and other places, and working out how we can make this travel to other colleagues. And so we wanted to think about how those learning designs would work in a range of tools and environments. And the conversations that we had came back to really simple things like PowerPoint. So Philip has just asked the question, you know, what tools do we need? And our conclusion quite early on in the piece was, with a background of professional development and staff development, our conclusion was, well, actually, we want them to be using the tools they're already using, if that's possible. I don't really want to have to support an academic member of staff to go through a process of learning a new design and development tool if they've already got on their desktop tools that they know how to use and they're going to use. My best way in to them in a professional development conversation is use what you've already got, but let's talk about the underlying ideas, the pedagogies, the way in which you might want to expand, think about what you do, and then share that with colleagues. So this is a simple example. You can probably identify down the left-hand side on the third slide down that that's the framework. So we would illustrate within the presentation, within a PowerPoint presentation, some aspects of the framework. We would describe the particular design. We would even populate it with an example. But then we would hand that PowerPoint presentation over to the individual academic who might be teaching dance or they might be teaching chemistry and say to them, it's for you to disassemble this now and use it in any way you want. So in my terms, at the risk of offending the reusable learning object community, this is a reusable learning object, by one definition anyway. You can take this, take it apart, discard the bits you don't want, populate it with the example that's meaningful for your students in your context, and use it again. We did the same thing with something as simple as Movie Maker. It works, you can do this with any slideware, you can do this with any movie software. Basically going through and saying, here are the individual elements. This is the process that you would go through in order to develop an interesting learning engagement based on one of the framework designs. You can go in and substitute your content, but it's there as guidance. So I think Philippa made the point about having some codified inside the example, some of that pedagogic guidance. And that's what we were looking to do and have been looking to do. In the context of Massey University, one of the applications which we use for developing content is called EXE, and which has some disadvantages. It's also referred to occasionally as, I think it's Front Page EXE. I confess the actual name of it escapes me sometimes. It has the slight disadvantage that being called EXE on Windows, it throws up all kinds of strange things with your security system. But what it does do is create XHTML content. It's basically an editor. It's a freestanding editor. It works on both platforms. And you can see over there on the far left-hand side, if you're able to see that, you can see that I've created what are called iDevices that detail some of those daily activities. So there's content there for defining the activity, defining the content, and so on. So what we're trying to do is to use the tools that staff in a particular context or any context can use, but put our designs into those tools rather than look at designing a tool that would support our designs. We've done it that way around. And this example on the right-hand side, you can see that left-hand screen is the authoring environment. The right-hand screen is the output in HTML. That's a very simple example. But again, it's something that is completely editable by any member of staff. They can take it, disassemble it, and so on. And we have looked at LAMS, and I was fortunate enough in April, I came and spoke to the Grainy's team about Compendium, and we're interested in how we might use those too. But at the moment, I have to confess, PowerPoint is actually the thing that excites me most. Because, as I say, from an educational developer's point of view, I know that the vast majority of teaching staff that I'm going to work with are going to use slideware. And so if I can get them to work with slideware and to look at learning designs in that context, then possibly you build the understanding of learning design and you build the idea that they can share. They can share PowerPoint presentations very easily with each other. And to encourage them even to do things like maybe write notes and commentary that are actually meaningful in the notes field so that when they pass their presentation on to another member of staff in their department or indeed a colleague in another university, you'd be able to pick that up and run with it. So I must admit, I've been sitting there looking at the time, rehearsing, and I thought I'd done rather well. So that's actually pretty good. Look, that's 20 minutes. So there are two things happening at the moment for us. One is that we're looking internally to develop these. And at the moment, I'll tell you one thing you could do for me today is you could come up with a better word than template. Because template for me seems far too rigid. Actually, we don't want to do templates. Because templates somehow do imply that you kind of get it, and it's already, there's already something there that you can't do too much to, that there is some restriction. And actually, we see something like PowerPoint as completely open and flexible, once, you know, within the limitations of someone's understanding of it as a tool. The idea that actually they can take something and completely strip it down, reuse it, redesign it, and exchange it with somebody else. So there's some opportunity to do that at the moment. And we'll be actually launching, is perhaps a grand word, but we're running a workshop at EduCause in November, and all of those templates will be made available to the community at that point. Probably in two or three different applications. One of the dangers about working with Kevin is Kevin actually keeps spotting new opportunities. So, you come to a meeting like this and someone presents a new particular application and you think, oh, it'd be quite good to do it for that too. At the moment, I think we're restricting ourselves to things like movieware and slideware. But we're also talking about how you might do it in something like Audacity. What kind of template could you provide people for audio-based designs and so on? But the important thing is we're looking at ubiquitous desktop software, not designing new tools. So if we're talking to somebody who already has LAMS, then we'd like to talk to them about LAMS. But if we're talking to somebody who has Moodle without LAMS, then we might want to explore within a Moodle context how you might actually codify some of those designs. The framework that we developed as part of the GISC project, the DALI framework, is available in some detail. There's a 15-minute kind of screencast that talks you through all the designs. And there are also some short videos that were produced for the GISC project, which also, again, explain the designs. Obviously, we're very happy to receive anyone who's traveling. I'm in New Zealand, so you're more than welcome if you happen to be down in that part of the world to come and say hello. And Kevin, as you can see, is at the University of Hull. And I'm available. You've got to be impressed, James, that I did that. I hope I was eloquent. I didn't babble, did I? I remember somebody telling me that public speaking, there are three things you shouldn't do. One is you shouldn't shout. One is you shouldn't lie. And the third one is you shouldn't be funny. And I always think that the fourth one is that you shouldn't actually panic and tell the truth. So, but I'm available for questions, if there are any. Or did I do that far too quickly and you're going to want me to go back and tell you what I meant by slide two? Martin, thank you, Martin.
That's slide two.
For using PowerPoint and making your slides look neat and all that stuff. It's about, for me, one of the things you begin to understand when you put your stuff up on SlideShare that you're competing in an attention economy. Your stuff needs to look good, you know, and loads of bulleted lists won't work. So I wonder whether you'd kind of started moving that into what you're doing, sort of factoring it in.
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think Andrew asked me in April about, you know, whether we looked at PowerPoint because that was an institutional, you know, that was the environment in which I was working institutionally. The reason the PowerPoint was being used as an example was that that's just the thing I'm most familiar with rather than Keynote or something else. But ultimately, yes, the idea of this kind of natural sharing that's almost beginning to occur for those people who are those kinds of digital citizens, yeah, those kind of environments where you go into SlideShare and you start sharing things, and then as a result of that, you realize that actually there is some value in that, but there's also some value in the feedback that you get and the comments that you get back. That does start. I think those are more sophisticated users. I'm still dealing with individuals who you have to persuade that they've done something worth sharing. And in some cases, that will mean literally emailing their PowerPoint around the department or putting it into perhaps putting it up in a form in a shared taught course so that other colleagues can also access it. We didn't really follow the thought process that you've just articulated. It literally was, how much effort would it be to get colleagues to actually learn to use a new tool? Whether it was the Glow tool or Xerxes or, you know, whatever kind of, there's some really good tools around, but they work with colleagues who are already quite technically able and who mentally are already in that frame of mind. How do I work with someone around the idea of reusable designs, around the idea of student engagement, when they might be at zero? most of them are at zero with bad, bad PowerPoint. And that the fallout from this is, even if at the end of this process, as an academic developer, even at the end of this process, if they're really not interested in learning designs and really don't get it, the chances are you've improved their use of PowerPoint a bit. So that's a win for, you know, the student experience. Yes, Patrick.
Hi, Simon. Welcome back.
Thank you.
What I'm very much involved in these days is the world of open educational resources and the challenge of getting the best out of those, or more out of those, for both the learner and the teacher. And I felt that some of what you were saying about sort of looking at these as, well, what would you do with a clip? Sort of, what would you do with an open educational resource is a very good starting point. But I was wondering exactly sort of how much it mattered whether you'd got a specific example to show people, or whether it was a better starting point in your experience, or particularly through perhaps your workshop experience, is it better to sort of get people to get the idea of, as you did with us just then, stimulate people by dropping the audio perhaps?
Yeah.
Or do you need to show this and build examples?
Yeah, you absolutely do need to show people. And if you come to EduCourse in November, no, Kevin set up a whole series of workshops as part of the original project. And what we found worked superbly at those was introducing this concept that perhaps it wasn't about content, but then just sitting people down in groups or pairs and working with some resource. So there's a fantastic example, which I'll try and do justice to in description, but there's a fantastic example of helicopters development, lots of clips from the 20s and 30s. And we gave no guidance. We just showed the clips, gave groups the clips, and said, what kind of things could you teach with this? And of course, depending on who you had sitting in those groups, engineers wanted to say, well, actually, there's something quite interesting here about the design process. Social historians would say, well, actually, isn't it quite interesting that you can see the way that people are relating to each other around the craft and who's there and who's not? And then somebody who I think was a political scientist said, oh, it's quite interesting that actually in the later clips you can start seeing people in uniform, but in the earlier clips you can't. And the point was, people were starting to take, with their own subject perspective, were starting to take different things out of the content. Whereas I think if we had said, here is a really beautiful clip for teaching people about engineering, then everyone's minds is already set. So yes, you do need to show people examples, but we found, I think, in the workshops that you needed to show people examples in the context of learning engagement, not in any kind of subject context. And we were really keen not to do that, which is where I do get a bit evangelical. Did that answer your question?
Yes. Yes, thank you very much.
I think that might be it, James.
No further questions, you could join me in
thank you very much.